W-O-W-O.
Bob, welcome to the history of WoWo.com.
Well, thanks, Randy. Happy to share some thoughts with you.
You have kind of a unique perspective because you were at WoWo twice.
Yes, I was.
What years? Tell us about that and what you did.
Exact years. Let's see. I went there in 1971, and I was production director, which meant the 7 or 8 copywriters that we had worked for me. And most of the stuff we did on the radio station was, you know, live copy. And I had to hire them. Then I had to produce commercials each day as each person got off the air. When Bob Sievers got off the air every morning, he'd come into the studio and have a stack of stuff for him to record. And some of it, I would put music behind it, or they'd have jingles or whatever. That's kind of what I did. And then as part of my job, if somebody was on, we had a full-time vacation person. Listo Fisher was his name at the time, who's in Boston now. And if somebody was on vacation, Listo normally did a Saturday night shift. And if someone was on vacation, I had to go on the air and do Listo's Saturday night shift so he could do the Monday through Friday shift.
So you were there in the early 70s, and you left when? You got there in 71.
I think it was 73 when I left there and went to Chicago.
And actually, we have your final air shift at WoWo from September of 73.
I'm not very proud of it, to tell you the truth. Air work was not my forte. I was a management guy, team guy, motivator, that kind of thing.
But then you did come back, more notably as program director, in what? What year was that?
Well, that would have been 77 or late 76. I'm not exactly sure the exact dates. It's all kind of foggy because it's a long time ago.
And you were there until what, 1979? Is that right?
Yeah, right. And then I left there for Denver. The thing with Westinghouse, Group W, who owned the station at the time, you kind of were in a farm team, so to speak. And WoWo was one of the stations that kind of everybody passed through if you wanted to make it up in the company. And my dream was to get either back to Boston or get to Pittsburgh KDKA. And what they said was, well, Bob, you got to be a program director at WoWo first. And then, you know, your next job after WoWo will be KDKA. And that was the carrot they dangled in front of me to get me to go back to WoWo. But it wasn't hard to get me to go back there because it was a fun place.
So when you went back, what was the on-air lineup? It didn't change a lot, really, in a lot of the 70s.
We actually did have quite a few people on the air. We had, you know, Sievers in the morning, and then Jack Underwood, Stu Collins in the afternoon, who later went to Chicago, and Bob Del Giorno, Bob Del at night, Calvin Richards, and Listo Fisher.
So that was the early 70s lineup.
Right.
The later 70s, tell us about that
lineup. When I got back there, let's see, Chris Roberts was afternoons.
Yeah.
And then Ron Gregory did nighttime.
Who was doing overnights?
Carol Ford.
Oh, yeah.
Who had just come from Ohio State University. First job in radio right out of school.
Let's talk about some of the interesting promotions that you were involved with at WoWo. And the first one that I want to ask you about, because I think you were the brain behind this, was Ho Ho WoWo.
Yes. Ho, ho, WoWo lives on today.
Now, for people who are not familiar with that, first of all, explain the concept.
Actually, it all started with a salesman who came to me with an order, and he said, I've got 150 canned hams from somebody, some advertiser in a farm show. I got 150 of these canned hams. Can we figure out a way to give them away? And I said, well, I don't know. I'll think about it. That's an awful lot of prizes to give away.
Was this in the early 70s or was this later?
This was the first time.
Okay.
This was in the early 70s. And that was one of the other things the production director did was, you know, came up with ideas for contests and that sort of thing.
Right.
And at the time, there were payphones all over the area, and payphones still had ringers in them back then. And so we made a call to the phone company and said, what are the chances of getting the numbers, the phone numbers of the payphones? And they said, oh, sure, we'll sell them to you. So we bought the list, and my idea was, if you hear a payphone ringing, answer it, ho, ho, wo, wo, because it was around Christmas time. And if you do, you'll get, you know, this canned ham. Whoopee. But WoWo had such power. It was such an influence. I mean, the personalities at WoWo were more celebrities than the TV news people or anybody on television in Fort Wayne, Indiana at that time.
Yep.
It was the king of media in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And so to win a canned ham from WoWo, it's like, wow, this is fantastic. So that's what we did. We would call up these payphones. And I would say 8 out of 10 times we would have a winner. And my wife and I would get a kick. We would go to the mall, and I would have my list, and I'd know which number they're going to call next. Uh-huh. We all had it on little flip cards at the station. So I'd sit down on a bench near a payphone somewhere at a park or at a shopping center or somewhere else where I knew they were going to call next, just to see what was going to happen. And you'd be amazed at how many people would try to knock each other out of the way to get to the payphone to answer the phone to win the silly canned ham. It was a hit. It was a big hit.
Now, that contest was played more than once, right?
Yeah. I have no idea how many times it was played after that. But I think I came up with that the last year I was there before I went to Chicago, and I lost track of how many times they played it after that.
I think most people who were listeners of Whoa Whoa in the 70s remember that because, first of all, it had such a memorable name.
Yeah. At one time, there was this whole thing of when I first got there, we were looking to do some new jingles. And everybody was saying, W-O-W-O. And when I would go someplace and they would find out I worked at W-O-W-O, they would say, oh, Whoa Whoa. And so I thought, if everybody calls it Whoa Whoa, why don't we call it Whoa Whoa?
So at the time you got there, you were not allowed to say Whoa Whoa on the air?
Well, it wasn't a matter they weren't allowed. It just wasn't the station signature.
Yeah.
The station signature was 1190 WOWO, which is hard to say for a lot of people. A lot of us.
Don Chevalette had mentioned that at some time during the 1960s, they actually did change that because they were not permitted to say Whoa.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the rules were much stricter. At one point, and they loosened up a little bit. And Westinghouse was one of the stricter broadcast companies. They made us jump through hoops because they wanted to be the best.
What other kind of promotions do you remember? I know the Air Aces were going on during both periods you were at the station.
We were contest central. Westinghouse, again, didn't allow us to do things like give away cash or those kinds of things. So we had to put on our creative hats. So we tried to have fun with them. And since everybody knew the people at Whoa, the personalities, they were bigger than life, we tried to have fun and build contests around them. Again, it helped the station build their image. And we thought it was more fun for the listeners than just spin the wheel and you win the prize. So we would come up with all kinds of things. Like we would have a mystery location where we would give clues and you'd have to guess what was there. We had one called Bob's Bag. And we built it around Bob Seavers. And Bob, lovable Bob, was known for being forgetful. And so it was forgetful Bob has left his bag somewhere in the Fort Wayne area. We're going to give you clues. Don't go looking for it. But if you help us find it, we'll give you. And again, Westinghouse wouldn't let us give away cash. So we would give away a $1,000 paid up MasterCard or something like that. So it forced us to be creative. And in the end, I think it was a good thing because I think it made us more creative than everybody else in town that was just doing the old boilerplate contests. So we did that one time. I remember they had this old steam engine in one of the parks, and the number on it was 767. And that was the final location. And so one of the clues was it's the same on each side and six in the middle. And we would... Another guy and I, Eric Stenberg, who was a salesman there, one of the account execs, we would have fun working together on these clues, and we usually try to make them rhyme or something like that. And we would test the clues on our wives. And when our wives figured out what it was, then we knew that the listeners were probably going to guess it the next day or so. So even though the contests weren't rigged, we could kind of control the length by making the clues kind of vague early on. Mm-hmm. And then we would hone in. And if they started to get too close, then we'd make them harder again. And it was fun. We would usually run a contest over 2 to 3 weeks. We didn't really get ratings, twice a year. And, Whoa Whoa was always, had 20 share. Bob Seavers could never understand, why don't I have 50% of the people listening to me? 50% should be listening to this radio station.
Well, in certain hours of Bob's show,
yes.
50% or even 60% of them were listening to him.
You had to listen to that show. Yeah. I mean, it was what everybody listened to there. And again, we would have fun with Bob. Bob went on a trip once I forget where it was. And he was known for going all over the tri-state area. And he would take these slides.
Yeah, travel logs.
Beautiful slides that he took. because he used this big format camera, and then he'd cut the slides down to 35 millimeter size, and they were just fantastic detail. So we did one contest called Bob's Forgotten Photo, and he had gone on a trip, I think with a bunch of listeners, and the premise was, you know, I took this picture here, and I'm seeing it, but I can't remember what it is. So we want you listeners to help us figure out what it is. And, you know, the prize was, who knows, a camera or something like that. And so he would again give clues. I think the destination where he left Bob's Forgotten Photo was Stonehenge. And so that was one of the other fun contests. Every month we came up with a new contest that would get listeners involved with the radio station. And our feeling was, is, you know, as we'd go out and around in the community, if we did something like that and we did it really well, we knew it was really well because people would be talking about it. Oh, did you hear? Bob Seaver's lost his bag somewhere and everybody's trying to find it. Gosh, they're giving away $1,000 in, septic tanks or something like that. And that reminds me, septic tanks. We had all kinds of unusual requests at WoWo for advertising promotions. Because we were known for doing contests, I would have the sales account exec come to me and say, Bob, I got a client who wants to give away a septic tank. Do you think we could come up with a contest built around that?
Did you actually give away a septic tank?
No. That's one I put my foot down on and said, no, I'm not going to do it.
I was going to say, I think I would have remembered that one.
No. That's one that didn't make it.
Well, one of the most historic things that happened during your time at WoWo was moving. You moved from the Gaskins building on West Washington over to the Central building at the corner of Wayne and Harrison. Now, that's only about a block and a half away, but moving a radio station is no simple matter. So just tell us about that.
Well, those studios, the Gaskins Building studios, which were just dreadful. I mean, there wasn't a window in the place. And you've heard of the world-famous fire escape. Well, that was where people would go out the back door on the third floor of the building to see what the weather really was that Earl Finkel was telling us about. And that was the only way we knew what was going on the outside. So it was just a dreadful building. It was supposed to be temporary studios. Well, 27 years is not exactly temporary, so it was time for the place to move. But I got to say, some great radio came out of that place.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't let the surroundings hamper what we were doing. So it was time to move, and that actually happened when I came back to WoWo. And that was one of the reasons I was agreed to come back, because I said, hey, I want to come back to that dismal place. What happened was, at the time, Westinghouse was a little tight on money. Yeah, I guess they were always a little tight on money. And they weren't going to give us money to buy all new equipment for the new studios. Even though the station was a virtual money cow for Westinghouse. But, of course, in comparison to a Los Angeles or New York or Boston, it wasn't that much. But we certainly paid our own way and made a good profit. So what we had to do was literally move the equipment from one studio to another, one building to the other. And they did give us enough money to buy a new production console. And, of course, by then I wasn't doing the production. Neil McGinley was the production director then. So what it was all planned one Sunday night. We would sign off the air on Sunday night with public affairs shows and then sign back on at 5 in the morning on Monday morning. So the plan was we sent all the public affairs tapes out to the transmitter. They played them from out there. And as soon as they started, we started everybody in the staff. It was a party. I mean, everybody came down and volunteered to help. And that was the thing with WoWo. I mean, it was like a big family. Everybody that worked there, just we had a wonderful time together. And they all came down, and we started carrying stuff over, chairs, desks, whatever, and the equipment. And because the place was designed to be a temporary housing for the radio station, wires were just laid on top of wires. So the chief engineer at the time, Billy Wolf, went into the control room with his wire cutters, and he had turned the power off, and he was going to cut the wires so that the power would go off and the board, the broadcast mixing console that we used to get the program on the air, would go silent and go down, lose its power. So he cut the wire, and guess what happened? The console didn't go off. It stayed on, and it started cutting other wires and other wires and other wires, and finally he got it. But we worked all through the night, finally signed it on at 5 in the morning. And you'll have a tape very soon of that first day when Bob signs it on in the new studios, and he and Dugan Fry talk about how they painted up the little red barn, looks good, and he makes jokes about some of the engineering people and myself taking a nap on a bale of hay because they've been here all night moving and cleaning things up.
Well, the most important thing about the new building, of course, is that it still
windows.
No, it had a fire escape. It still had a fire escape.
It had to have a fire escape. That was one of the requirements. The new place had to have a fire escape. And Warren Maurer, who I think had selected the site before I got there, he was the general manager at the time, did a very, very good job of selecting a great location for the station to move to. And my office had a window. I could tell you another great story, if you'd like, about how popular WoWo was. When I was there the first time in the early 70s, all of a sudden, I was listening to the station, and one day, about 12:15, the audio dropped. It was about half volume, and we couldn't figure out what was going on, and everything was going out of the building normal, and so we called out to the transmitter, and everything all of a sudden dropped, and they couldn't figure out why. And about 30 minutes later, it went back up, but nobody could troubleshoot it and fix it. So the next day, it happened again, and the next day, it happened again. And so we got the phone company. Now, the station had these special lines that went between the studios and the transmitter. And come to find out, in talking to the phone company, they found that some telephone person in the telephone office was taking their lunch at that time every day. And he would take his clips on his handset, you know, his test set, and clip it across the wire so he could listen to the noon Little Red Barn. And that was draining the audio, so that's why we went down half of the audio every day for a few days on that.
Speaking of the Little Red Barn, one of your assignments when you came back as program director had to do with Jay Gould, and maybe you can just kind of explain what you had to do and how that went with Jay.
Well, Jay was getting up in years, and he wanted to spend less time on the air, but obviously the station made an awful lot of revenue off of the Little Red Barn and all the farming stuff that he did. Mm-hmm. And so my challenge was to make the transition by still keeping Jay's presence on the air, still retaining the advertising revenue, but yet phasing in another person to host the show, to go on to do it for years. And it was Dugan Fry, and Dugan Fry was very, very successful at filling Jay's shoes. And so what we did is we would get Jay in a couple times a week, and he would record segments, and Bob would throw it to him. And you'll hear this on the first day in the new studios, where Bob says, well, let's go over to Jay Gould, and now he's talking to Sally from the 4-H club in Pawpaw, Michigan, or whatever. That was one of my assignments, was this is what you have to do going back there. This is your challenge, is you got to make this transition, but you can't lose any of the advertising revenue, and you got to keep the feel and the flavor of the Little Red Barn and the agribusiness.
Talk for a moment about what it was like being the program director for Bob Sievers, because it's kind of like being the baseball manager for Babe Ruth. I know that there were some program directors who said, Bob, stop reading the lost dog announcements on the air. Now, you weren't one of those guys, were you?
Oh, yes. We were all like that. We knew he was going to do it, and we wanted him to do it. If we hadn't said that, the whole show would have been lost dog announcements, because Bob cared so much about his listeners.
Yep.
He truly loved them, and he was an animal lover. And if he could have put out nothing but lost dog announcements, he would have done it. And he had a hard time resisting putting those on the air. And so, no, we didn't really want him to stop doing it. When I became program director and I went back to WoWo for the second time, I ran into Bob Sievers the first morning, and he pointed his finger and he said, you know, Bob, you're number 18. I said, what do you mean, Bob? He says, you're the 18th program director. I've been here 30 years, and I've outlasted 18 program directors. I just want you to know that. And he didn't. He did it in a sweet way. I mean, he was, you know, joking. But it was true. I mean, this man was just so wonderful. He was the radio station. He was Fort Wayne, Indiana. He knew his audience. He loved his audience. They loved him. He was a wonderful person. He was a little kid. And at one point, And this was one of the other assignments I had when I went back, was the program director preceding me wanted to make the station sound very, very slick, very much like a, this would be two radio terms for a lot of people, but Bill Drake or the Top 40 sound, a real tight New York sound, because he came from New York. And so he told Bob he couldn't play his hymn every morning in the Little Red Barn. And Bob stopped. And one of the very first things I did, of course, when I got back there was, Bob, where's your hymn? You had to get Tennessee Ernie Ford back on there. So, I mean, I knew this was what the radio station needed. And the reason this guy was doing this was it was about that time when WMEE was consulted by one of the greats in radio consulting, Mike Joseph. And Mike Joseph was consulting WMEE, and they were doing all the right things. They were doing all the guerrilla warfare kinds of things that you do. So the program director was reacting by trying to copy them, and it just wasn't working, and rightly so. I mean, it had its mission, it knew what it was supposed to do, and so it was, you know, not that difficult for me to figure out, hey, let's do what WOWO is all about. Let's be the community, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we did those jingles, you know. WOWO Land is a great place to be, and that's a slogan. I think I came up with that slogan.
I was just about
I'll take
to
credit
ask
for
that.
It. Sure, I'll take credit for that. Because everybody that lived there was very proud of it. And it was a great time to be there, and it was a wonderful radio station, and the people that were there were just magnificent. The people at WOWO were what made that radio station be what it was, all the way from the salespeople to the people in the front office to the people on air. It was a fantastic team. It was like you think of a smaller town in Indiana as being a rural area. True, it is. But WOWO was like a big city radio station. I mean, how many other radio stations? I forget what the staff was. It must have been 40 or 50 or so. And that's unheard of. We were a big fish, a big radio station, in a much smaller market. And it was a very fun time. I have many, many fond memories of WOWO.
You brought up jingles. I remember some WOWO jingles that I don't know if this predated you or not. There were ones where they sang different cities.
I'm a Sturgis, Shipshewana, Hunter Town, and Logansport, Fort Wayne, Auburn, Defiance, too.
Was that when you were there, or was that prior to that?
It was. I had those done, and those were not custom.
Those were originally done for what, WBZ?
WBZ.
Yeah.
It was when we were coming up with the concept of WOWO Land is a great place to be. And I heard those WBZ jingles, and I said, oh, we got to have those. The tough part was finding all of the towns to fit in, because Bluffton, Portland.
You know what? I have to interject there, because I lived in Bluffton, grew up in Bluffton,
right.
And everyone in Bluffton was highly insulted when it was not in those jingles.
I thought, sure, we had Bluffton in there.
I think that jingle was one of them that everybody remembers, because I've played it for many people and their eyes light up.
It was one of my favorites.
How did that work? Did you just write down a list of them and send that to Dallas and they just put it together, or did you actively help them, you know, craft that?
We had to actively help them craft it. It was not an easy task putting that one together. And the singers really had a tough time. It was much more difficult for them to do those than the ones they did for WBZ, because we were cramming a lot more difficult cities in there. And, of course, we had to help them out to say it's Salina, not Selena.
Right, right.
And, you know, get the pronunciations right. I think we did two of those with two sets of cities, as I recall. And they were 60-second jingles that you didn't use a whole lot. And I'm sure Bluffton was in one of those. Well, of course, Bluffton was the home of one of the three Jack Surplus cities, Portland, Bluffton, and Salina, Ohio.
That was probably the city's biggest claim to fame at that time. That's true.
Right. Do you want to hear the commercial stories about Jack Surplus City?
Sure.
Jack Surplus City was a place that was having these bargain sales all the time. And the copy was all written by our copywriters who worked for me. And they would sometimes have typos, and you would be reading them live, and sometimes you'd be reading them for the first time as they went on the air.
And these were almost like laundry lists of things that we had on sale, right? One after another.
And you just read through it, not really paying much attention to what you said, fortunately. And I remember one of the most memorable ones was, Jack's this weekend has a sale on little girl slightly soiled panties, half off.
One thing we haven't talked about yet are the Aces, I guess what it was not the Air Aces. They were just called the WoWo Aces
the
basketball
mighty
team.
WoWo Aces. The mighty WoWo Aces.
Well, tell me about some of your memories of that.
Well, I didn't come up with that concept. That was already there when I got there.
Yep.
And it was just a great, great concept. Again, it was getting out and serving the audience in the area. And we would, every Monday night or Tuesday, I forget what night it was of the week, we would travel sometimes up to 75 miles each way or more to go to a high school. And all of this, you know, as many of the staff could, and plus we had a couple of ringers who would go along with us too, we would go and we would play basketball against the faculty team at a high school, and then they would use the money for a pet project, new band uniforms or something like that. And just about everybody on the staff was willing to go, and as I recall, I think the staff members that went got 20 or 25 bucks for going, which was, you know, peanuts to go out. And many times it'd be snowing and sleeting. We'd do this in the middle of winter, the worst weather of the year. And we had a script, and Jack Underwood was always the announcer. And I still have that script. It's got all the cornball lines stolen from the Harlem Globetrotters and some original stuff. And, you know, there'd always be the water bucket episode where Coach Bob Sievers would go chasing someone with a bucket of water, and they'd go up into the audience, and he'd throw it, and, of course, confetti would come out. But it's still, every time, they'd scream. It was great stuff. And we had a couple of ham radio operators. Bob Sievers was one. Chris Roberts was one. Stu Collins was another one. And they would talk back and forth to each other on their ham radio units, as portable units, as we were driving from high school to high school. But that's what we did in the winter, and it was just a big hit. And they would sell this thing out, and sometimes the high school faculty teams would start to play for real, and they'd start to get rough on our guys. And we would tell them in advance, because we had a couple of big ringers.
Yeah, Bob Pelkington.
Yes.
Yeah, he was a well-known player, yeah.
Nasty guys. And so he said, if you guys start to go in on the WoWo personalities, we're going to open up on you. So sometimes they had to do that, but it wasn't too often. And then, of course, always before or after, we'd have a nice spaghetti supper or something like that, a buffet cooked by the local church members who had just had Bob Sievers there the night before doing his slideshow on Africa. That was the other thing. Bob Sievers would go all over the place. Every night he was somewhere. I don't think he spent a night at home. He was out always somewhere at some church, some spaghetti supper or something like that, doing his slide presentation. And most times he didn't get paid.
Yeah. And he did that for, I would say, easily 35 years.
Yeah.
Even up until he retired and beyond. He just enjoyed doing it. And it was such a tremendous service that helped all of these organizations that Bob would appear at.
I can't think of another morning man anywhere who knew and served his community, his audience, as well as Bob Sievers, without a doubt, in my mind. And I've worked at a lot of radio stations for a lot of years.
And speaking of that, after you left WoWo, what else did you go on to do?
Oh, gosh. From there, I went to Denver, to KOA, spent 4 or 5 years in the Rocky Mountains, really enjoyed that. From there, went to Philadelphia to work for CBS at WCAU. From there, went to Seattle to be general manager of a station there. And then after that, I came to Albuquerque, New Mexico to work for a great Westinghouse guy who invented the all-news format, Art Schreiber, at KOB. Hmm. And then my last actual radio jobs, programming radio stations, were back in Los Angeles, my hometown, where I grew up in the Los Angeles area, programming KABC and KMPC, two talk radio stations
there. Bob, this has been just a lot of fun, and you certainly have been very helpful with this website, so I want to say thank you for that.
Oh, got more coming.